Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Paul Starr, a Pulitzer Prize-winning professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton. He's also the co-editor with Robert Kuttner and co-founder with Robert Kuttner and Robert Reich of The American Prospect. His book, The Social Transformation of American Medicine, won the 1984 Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction, as well as the Bancroft Prize. In 1993, he was a senior advisor for President Bill Clinton's proposed healthcare reform plan, and he has an article at The New Republic, The Healthcare Mandate Really Was a Mistake. And his latest book is Remedy and Reaction, The Peculiar American Struggle Over Healthcare Reform. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Starr.
Glad to be with you, Ian.
And back in January, you wrote in The New Republic that the healthcare mandate really was a mistake, and you argued that the president miscalculated about the courts, the politics, and the policy itself. And this is before the Supreme Court got there. I got with the hands on it. I don't know whether that's the right analogy, but ripped into it. I guess if there's any vindication to feel, it's not particularly satisfactory. What's your sense of where this is going to end up in terms of a ruling?
Oh, I don't know how Anthony Kennedy is going to vote. I was there in the courtroom for the oral argument on the individual mandate, and it went very badly, I would say, in the first hour. But by the end, there was great uncertainty, I think, really, as to how Kennedy would come out. But look, let me just backtrack a bit. I support the law. I believe it is constitutional. But during the debate about the legislation, I argued that the mandate was a mistake. It was a political mistake. I was afraid that it would stir up a backlash. I was afraid that it would create an adversarial relationship between the government and the people it was trying to help, the people who are uninsured. I'd done radio shows with calls from people who weren't really right-wing, but who thought the mandate was going to end up forcing them to pay money they couldn't afford or send them to jail. And I'd explain, well, there are going to be subsidies in the law, and many people just wouldn't believe it. And I realized there's a lot of distrust out there. And so I started to take a look at how other countries deal with this. I started to think, is there some way that we could have a safety valve, that we could have an opt-out? And I became convinced that, yes, we could. The mandate really wasn't essential. And if you step back and think about other programs, not all health insurance programs are mandatory. In Medicare, Part B, the physician's coverage, is voluntary. And the prescription drug coverage is voluntary. They work because they're overwhelmingly such good deals. People don't turn them down. And that's the first thing you have to consider. How good a deal is a program? And actually, under the Affordable Care Act, the subsidies for low-income people are very good, and that will drive most of the new coverage. The mandate itself has some effect, but I'm not convinced it has all that much effect. And here's one thing that most people do not understand about the mandate. It's not really a mandate. It's very lightly enforced. As one of the appellate judges said, this is a mandate that depends on voluntary compliance. No one's going to go to jail. The government is not going to garnish anybody's wages. It's not going to seize any property. There's none of the enforcement power as there is for taxes. There's only one thing the government can do to collect the fines if you don't insure, and that's to withhold a tax refund. And that's not much enforcement power.
So why did the administration then fall victim to its own semantical trap? In other words, why use that word mandate if indeed, and I wondered during these arguments why nobody proffered what you just said, which is really, they're not really strict mandates because, the, as you pointed out, there are no liens, there are no IRS heavy-handed tactics. It's the you know, all that would happen is you would have less of a tax refund.
Yeah, well, from the standpoint of the law, if the court were to uphold the mandate, Congress could, of course, later increase the penalties. So I think from, you know, the court has to consider the mandate as a policy in and of itself. Actually, let me just amend that. What people call the mandate under the law actually refers to two separate provisions in the statute. One of the provisions says that people have an obligation to maintain a minimum level of insurance coverage. The other provision sets these penalties, which, as I say, are very likely enforced, but it sets the penalties. It is conceivable that the court could strike down the mandate, the requirement to maintain coverage, and leave the penalties. That is possible, and I think Justice Roberts almost hinted at that possibility at one point. I don't think this is very likely, but it is something that I think hasn't received enough discussion.
Well, of course, the Paul Clement, arguing for the 26 states, said if you struck down the mandate, the whole bill is gutted. Why didn't they think? Why, for example, didn't they use tax credits instead of this mechanism that they've come up with? Wouldn't that have avoided any legal challenge?
Well, the subsidies for insurance are in the form of tax credits, and they are a tremendous inducement to take out insurance, to use the health, new health insurance exchanges, and I really believe that that is the fundamental force that would drive increased levels of insurance coverage. But so let me explain my alternative that I proposed while the law was under consideration. I couldn't get anybody's serious attention on this. But I thought of the device that's used in the German health insurance system. And in the German health insurance system, people can opt out of the public or the statutory insurance funds. But if they do that in Germany, they opt out for life. They can't come back in. And I thought, well, that's too harsh, but why don't we make it a long-term opt-out? You can opt out, no penalty, but for 5 years, you'd have to stay outside the program, and that would mean you wouldn't be eligible for the subsidies, you wouldn't be eligible to use the insurance exchanges, you couldn't necessarily get a policy with no pre-existing conditions. You could look for insurance, it just wouldn't have all the benefits of the law. So you'd be no worse off than before. But I believe that if you structured the opt-out as a long-term opt-out, relatively few people would actually take it. They'd have to sign a form on their taxes, and I think people would be reluctant to waive those rights. So I believed you'd actually get a very good result in terms of people complying with the program and getting insurance, but you'd do it without the compulsion, and I think it would have obviated the whole case before the Supreme Court.
So, again, Paul Starr, Pulitzer Prize-winning professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton. He was on a senior advisor to President Bill Clinton's proposed health care reform plan, and he has an article at the New Republic, The Health Care Mandate Really Was a Mistake, and his latest book is Remedy and Reaction, The Peculiar American Struggle Over Health Care Reform. So the kind of Tea Party, don't tread on me, people who are particularly angry about this, and it's worth noting that the Kaiser Foundation has shown that there's overall support for the Affordable Care Act, but the one aspect of it that's unpopular is the individual mandate. And again, I'm trying to figure out how, I mean, nobody can say that the Obama administration has done a great job selling this. A lot of the good parts of it are backloaded, so people won't really feel the benefits. I think a lot of people pre-existing conditions and having kids at home should be supporting it because they have real world experience with it. But the two things that bother the right in this are the notion that one, you're subsidizing freeloaders, and two, that big government is telling you what you have to do. It seems like those could have been avoided.
I do think the mandate could have been avoided. I think the mandate is kind of like waving a red flag in front of a bull. It does epitomize for many people government overreach, and that was what I was worried about, and why I thought we should look for alternatives. I very much want to see this legislation succeed. I want to see it have a chance. I think once it did go into effect, people would understand it and would see that it's a good thing. But we may never get there because of the opposition and because of the court decision.
But in terms of the pool of uninsured, which this plan, and it did come out of the insurance companies, if you will. I mean, the president initially talked about a public option. He never embraced single payer. It's difficult to know how serious he was about a public option, but the long the short of it is, he went this route, and this, of course, guarantees insurance companies an awful lot of new customers, but then how do you pay for these new customers?
But let me just say something. The insurance industry did not support the legislation. They never took any position. The big insurance companies fought against it. They spent more than $80 million at the end on advertising to defeat it. So don't identify this with the insurance industry.
Right. I thought they initially supported, but then they turned against it. That's not true.
They never supported it. They were unable, unlike the hospitals and the pharmaceuticals. This is all in my book, Remedy.
Right. I obviously need to read your book, clearly. But go ahead.
Some of the other interest groups were able to come up with a list of things that they wanted, and they went in to the White House, they went in to see Max Baucus, and they got a deal. The insurance industry was never able to resolve its own internal differences among different insurance companies. Uh-huh. They were never able to work out a list of the three things or four things that they wanted. They never got a deal. And in the end, of course, I don't know if you remember this, but back in late 2009 and 2010, the administration turned very sharply against the insurance industry.
The same thing happened, didn't it? It was Clinton to a lesser extent, right?
Worse.
Yeah, I mean,
business turned altogether against.
Right,
against
with Harry and back. Louise or whatever. Yeah. But what about the options that weren't taken, particularly expanding Medicare and stuff like that? Why did they go this route? The most progressives think it was just big, powerful lobbyists overwhelmed the idea of single payer or even the public option or expanded Medicare.
Well, expanding Medicare has many virtues, and I think if the Supreme Court strikes down the mandate and this whole law, including the Medicaid expansion, expanding Medicare is going to get a lot more attention because it'll be the only route available at the national level. But the problem with expanding Medicare is, well, there's several problems. First of all, many seniors believe that Medicare is just for them, and they are not going to be enthusiastic about opening up Medicare to others. The Medicare program pays hospitals and doctors less than private insurers. And so the hospitals and the doctors don't like the idea of shifting populations from private insurance to Medicare. And what makes this especially complicated is that Medicare payments are particularly low in relation to private insurance payments in some areas, for example, Iowa, Minnesota, and even the liberal representatives from those states have heard from their hospitals that say, if we move to Medicare and Medicare rates, we're going to become insolvent. We're going to go broke. And so you've got some actually very liberal representatives from those states who are not enthusiastic about expanding Medicare. There are all of these complications. I'm not saying that we couldn't get over these difficulties. It's not easy. These other routes that have been at the center of political attention have been have been easier to sell to the great variety of interests and to the public at large.
Sure. I frankly think that it's going to be tough no matter what you come up with revisiting this. I mean, some Democratic strategists like Bob Schrum are saying if the Supreme Court strikes this down, it'll be great for the Democratic base. They'll be all riled up and come out to vote. That seems absurd to my mind. I think it'll be a humiliation and a defeat. And people in this country, nice guys finish last. You want people, American voters want people that are effective, not well-meaning.
I agree with you. It'll be very demoralizing. And I don't see how you can spin it as a good thing.
So, but just to go back though to the current mechanism that's in the balance here. My understanding is that the very people that you'd be trying to bring into the uninsured, the 40 million or 50 million now it is, I believe, that you're trying to bring in are mostly people on the lower income end. And I'm not sure that do they file taxes? Would you be able to have that ability to withhold tax refunds?
Well, let me just clarify something. If you have an income below the tax threshold, you're not subject to the mandate anyway.
I see.
Okay, the mandate does not affect them at all. The mandate also has a hardship exemption. There hasn't been enough discussion about this. If health insurance, even after the subsidies, would cost more than 8% of your income, the mandate does not apply. You're exempt from it. There's also a religious exemption. There are a number of other exemptions. It turns out, actually, when you go through the numbers, not that many people would be subject to the mandate. That's another irony of the whole thing.
Well, all I can say, Paul Starr, is I wish they were listening to you, and I wish your voice had been available all around the country in these last months, because most of the points that you've, in fact, everything you've told us tonight should have been what the White House have been saying for in their defense around the clock.
There's been great reluctance to discuss this forthrightly, and I think it's been a very big mistake. Goes back to the whole question of whether there should have been a mandate in the law. And let me just say something. You know, it's hard to wind back the clock, remember exactly what was going on.
Right.
During the debate on the legislation, there wasn't much of a focus on the mandate. There was a lot of discussion about the public option. There was a lot of discussion about abortion coverage. There were many other things that got attention. But the mandate was not the focus of much news coverage. And I think many Democrats, including those in the White House, were lulled into overconfidence because originally the mandate was a Republican idea.
Sure.
It was a conservative idea. So who expected them to turn around and repudiate it and say it was unconstitutional?
Well, that's exactly what Mitt Romney's doing right now.
It's amazing.
Yeah, he's running from the word mandate like it's a, you know, it's a, you know, a vampire. Anyway,
yeah,
sorry.
And, of course, he was not only the one to pass the mandate for the first time in a state, but he made it clear that he thought that was a national model.
Sure. Yeah. Well, look, I thank you for joining us here today, Paul Starr.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Paul Starr, Pulitzer Prize-winning professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton. He's also the co-editor with Robert Kuttner and co-founder with Robert Kuttner and Robert Reich of The American Prospect. His book, The Social Transformation of American Medicine, won the 1984 Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction, as well as the Bancroft Prize. In 1993, he was the senior advisor for Bill Clinton's proposed healthcare reform plan, and he had an article at The New Republic, The Healthcare Mandate Really Was a Mistake. And his latest book is Remedy and Reaction, The Peculiar American Struggle Over Healthcare Reform. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment talking about what went on in the White House between the president and the Canadian prime minister.
Hold on, you don't.